you're a lender who's doing great business. You're raising money from your investors. You put the money out on loans, and then more borrowers come in the door because you're growing and you have relationships and things are going great because the market is strong and your shop is just getting more visibility and you're getting more business. So you go back to your lenders, you raise more money because your other money's out on the street right now and you have to wait till that pays off. And then the next month, repeat, great problem. Okay, so you can only go back to that equity well so many times, right? You know, you've got to basically think about investors constantly, which is something you should be doing anyway. But, you know, you can only go back and say, now we need more money. Now we need more money. Things are great. We need more money. You know, at some point, that well dries up.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
David Blatt is the CEO of CapStack Partners, focused on helping clients find real estate, investment, and capital solutions. He is also the founder and CEO of Banksell, the first lender-to-lender marketplace to syndicate, buy, and sell real estate loans. With a background in distressed real estate, Mr. Blatt has successfully structured and closed countless complex deals, and he's also a frequent public speaker and writer on innovation and capital market trends in real estate. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
The pleasure's mine. You've got a lot of fun things going on. I know we talked here, you know, before the show kicked off on just kind of the innovative and unique things that you guys are working on. But before we really dig into the nuts and bolts of that, same three questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Those are three simple questions with long answers. So I started in real estate specifically about 20 years ago. I loved the asset class in the industry. I just saw it as a vehicle to really be able to build personal wealth, you know, long term. And so my first gig, I was looking around trying to figure out where my entry point was. And it was a development group that was looking to hire a secretary. I loved what they were doing in the distressed real estate space. They were focused on contaminated properties at the time. And so I basically said, hey, I'm willing to fetch your coffee, send the mail, do whatever you need to do. I'll take that receptionist job, but I want to learn everything I can from you with the caveat that you understand that the second I feel like I do have an understanding, I'm out, because my game plan was always to start my own shop. And so that's what I did. That was my first job. And it's where I learned the distressed real estate space. It's how I learned about real estate finance. And it was really the jump off to my career.
That's awesome. I love that hustle and grind. You know, and I think a lot of people miss that early on because they say, all right, I want to go big. I want to figure this out. And he said, and I'll work the mailroom. I don't care. As long as I get the front row seat to what you guys are doing, by all means, right?
That's exactly right. I really looked at it as like hands-on apprenticeship. I've always been an entrepreneur. I always knew that I wanted to build something of my own. You know, and you really have a couple of paths to do that, right? You can go and work for a big shop, get that pedigree, you know, that name association with like a big firm, and certainly the discipline, or you can do it at that like small shop, grind it out level, like boots on the ground, frontline kind of thing. And so I saw that really is a better path because I'd be working next to the CEO of that company and really just picking up all the pieces of that one needs to really run their own platform. So that was much more interesting to me.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Yeah, that sounds like the right strategy there. Let's fast forward to what it is that you're doing really in your day-to-day now. Where are you now?
So I manage an investment fund now that is buying performing and non-performing commercial mortgages from other lenders throughout the country in markets that we like. We're really, rather than being a lender that a borrower in real estate is more familiar with, we're actually trading with those lenders and building a portfolio of loans through the relationships that we have with other lenders. So it's kind of like one level up, and really like our lender is the client versus an end borrower, even if we obviously end up with a loan and do work with the borrower once that's on our books.
What has that been like? Because obviously you guys have to have capital to go out and buy these non-performing or performing notes, right? So what was that like raising the capital for that?
So, you know, that capital raising in and of itself is a job and a responsibility and a skill set. So it's something that you need to tend to as much as you need to tend to the deal flow pipeline, you know, and talking about it in the context of a fund vehicle, you're really talking about it from an input output kind of way. And you really have to balance the two because it's an ongoing endeavor, right? You know, it's one thing to raise money on a deal and closing that particular transaction. You know, you grind on the front end, you know, you put that money together. It'll probably be friends and family, you know, or wherever the source could be. But the second you hit that number that you need to close on the acquisition or whatever the business plan is, you're done, right? And then you go to that next stage of executing on your business plan to manage the asset, create the, you know, value or whatever it is that you've laid out to get it to the point where on the back end, you've now delivered hopefully a profitable exit for you and your investors, right? Which is a lot easier. In a fund context, the credits never really roll to a large extent, right? You're constantly managing the capital raising and investment management process, and it's critical to be able to do that. And at the same time, you also have to make sure that there are deals, plural, coming in the door currently as well as, you know, going forward so that you're utilizing that investor capital in the way that investors gave it to you and, you know, to justify why they gave it to you. So a little bit of, call it a layer of complexity to that one-off. You know, but the trade-off is when you raise money on a deal and you hit a home run, ideally, and you return that money to the investors. Inevitably, you know, when you've done a great job, they always ask, okay, great, where's the next deal, right? So I always think of it like you've just driven yourself out of a job, right? You kind of got to go and, you know, sort of figuratively go get another job. So you know, when you're dealing with a fund vehicle, it's a little more stable in that way because the fund is the next job, right? The deal that you liquidated and now you're moving into the next deal within the scope of the fund. That is the deal. So it's a lot easier to manage to that end. You just got to keep deals coming in the door.
Yes. Well, I mean, and you're basically upping the ante on the two things that we need to succeed in real estate, which is deals and money.
Pretty much, right?
Yeah. You're just shortening the hamster wheel to where it just spins faster. It's like, oh my gosh, we got more deals, more money, more deals, more money.
Right, right. Yeah, it's sort of like a perpetual wheel to some degree, right? You just get adept at, or rather, you need to be adept at, you know, managing that facet of it versus the sequential get on the ride, get off the ride, get on the ride, get off the ride. You know, which is another path, you know, but if you're going that route, then, you know, you just want to try to be really managing all ends of that for sure.
Yeah. And I would imagine that, you know, on just staying on the capital raise conversation side of this, you're constantly needing to generate new sources of capital because you can probably tap out investors at some extent, or am I incorrect?
You absolutely need to be conscientious of introducing new investors into the fund. And by the same token, I would add that you need to also consider, you know, the double-edged sword of that in that, you know, when you're so focused on trying to raise enough money to cover the deal flow that you have or prospectively can get your hands on, you know, the other side of that is you don't want to raise so much money in a given point in time that you're not deploying that capital into deals, right? And so it's nice to perhaps get approached by an investor group or a high volume of investors at some point that are willing to throw a ton of money your way. And it's really enticing to take advantage of that. But you also want to think about, well, this is a, you know, in a fund vehicle, right? You're being measured on your overall performance, not that one deal that was a home run and the other one that's still waiting. And the cash that's sitting in the bank, all of that contributes, right? And so, you know, one of the things that you need to manage is like, okay, how much am I going to take in now? And how much am I going to have to turn away, which is a discipline, right? And it's a luxurious discipline, right? You want to be able to get to a stage like that. And, you know, maybe you let it in 6 months or in a year or whatever that is. to try to be responsible about, okay, how much money am I going to take on right now? Because I can reasonably deploy that and hit my targets for the benefit of the fund, and then go back out and let more money in, you know, at an appropriate stage, and, you know, so on.
Yes, that's an interesting perspective. And that we, you know, as I've heard it said many times, your problems never go away. They just change.
I think that's accurate.
Yeah. When you're getting started in real estate, you're going, crud, man, I need deals. Crud, I need money. And you're always balancing this. And then once you get a track record, once you start establishing and having, now you're balancing going, okay, I need to hold the money back. I need to make sure we can deploy this responsibly. It's not that, yeah, the problems never go away. They just change. So that's fascinating. I really enjoy you taking the time to dig into kind of some of those thoughts and how you guys have to approach your business and being responsible on that front. If you had the experience where you did have too much capital and then couldn't actually get it deployed in a timely manner?
We haven't run into that so far, luckily. That's also about trying to get a handle on what the prospective pipeline can look like. Right. So the ideal situation is where you are opening up a fund to bring in investors and know, okay, I'm doing this because there's always a spike around this time of year, or I have certain deals that are on the horizon that I think I'll get my hands on, or there's enough activity in the market, or I have a relationship with like a seller of some profile that is going to reliably send me deal flow of this sizing. It's that kind of stuff that you want to just try to be as thoughtful about in terms of what your projections can be. The guiding principle here is that a zero return on capital per day is effectively a loss, right? You've made zero for that money that day. So you really want to think about, I got to get this money to work. And then compensating for the fact that you always have some cash reserves, you know, sitting on the sidelines anyway, just because you want to have some cash, right? That's just a component of what you need to bake in, which means you have to think about, okay, what's the level of return I need on those dollars that are actually working for the fund? Because the stuff that's sitting in the bank is creating drag as a counterbalance.
Yep. Yep. Those are certainly a lot of things to think about. And I love that you put it zero for that day. You know, that's a lot of times we think about annualized returns, things like that. But if you break it down to a very day-by-day component of, is this working? That puts a lot more urgency to those sort of things when you're thinking about, okay, there's cash sitting idle.
Oh, 100%, right? A zero IRR day is a loss. That's like just what it is.
The other side of your business that I think is intriguing, of course, as well, is the deal side. You told me offline you guys do both non-performing and performing commercial mortgages. Talk to us about the non-performing side. I think that's something that, you know, one, we'd find intriguing. Two, I'd love to hear if there's an uptick in that, if we anticipate an uptick in that, and really just kind of get your forecast on that front. So if you can break down the components of it and then maybe what you see coming down the pipe.
Yeah. So just to fill in a blank between my first gig and where I am now for context, my platform that I launched right after I left that shop was a distressed fund platform. So I ran a specifically distressed fund buying defaulted commercial mortgages for 10 years into and through last recession. And it, to the point that it was scaled to about $1 billion AUM. We had a private equity fund that had stepped in to back us like right as the recession was just like starting, like with the whole meltdown, big short situation. Like that was our time to shine. And so I have a tremendous amount of experience in the distressed space. And more so, I have, call it, two decades of relationships with banks and lenders that we've still traded with. I ended up dissolving the fund and forming CapStack Partners, my current platform, mainly because the market came back. There wasn't much distress to chase to support a fund. So going back to the zero IRR days, like at that point, you know, you just got to read the market. And so we were doing one-off deals and it's been working to that extent until we were able to scale it to a fund that exists today, which is doing both the performing and non-performing. So I just needed to fill that in for context. So to answer your question more specifically and directly, the short answer is I've certainly seen an uptick. I wouldn't predict that it's a signal on the overall market. I actually believe that the overall market is very healthy and robust, both from the real estate and real estate debt side of the equation. The reason that we have a pretty steady flow of deals is a function of the relationships that I have with lenders. So I'm not chasing deals on the distressed side as much as solving problems for lenders that know that that's what I do. So we're getting offered this stuff because of our position in the market, which is a nice place to be. You know, and there's always one or two deals that go sideways for a given lender, you know, that they just need to move off their books, right? So my view on that is I don't need to buy a massive portfolio of distressed deals in order to justify having a fund that buys distressed deals. I just need to have enough relationships where the one or two that they need to move get directed my way. So that's how we build a portfolio. In terms of the kind of like the other element, which I would say is reflective of the timing, you know, there are a number of deals that went offline when COVID lockdown happened. And, you know, they were put in what I would describe as like induced comas, you know, as it relates to a lot of like loan forbearances and sort of like a timeout, right? Well, timeout's over and a lot of these loans have come back online and have started to perform. And then there are those that just are not performing and won't be coming back online. And so the lenders, contrary to how you would think about it, because the banks are doing so well, they're actually really profitable. They're doing great. And they're in the money business, right? So for them to have a deal locked up in some non-performing loan makes zero sense. They're much better just writing that thing off and rolling that money back out into a good loan. So there has been what I would describe as like a great reopening kind of spike right now that we're starting to see. I think that'll last for maybe into next year as lenders are just kind of allowing all of that forbearance runway to burn off. You know, so I do expect that some more just kind of like market data to consider is that there's also a lot of traditional loan maturities that happen to be coming up that is just sort of like coinciding with these, you know, coming back online or rather not coming back online forbearance situations. And I think when you have that, it does create a little bit of a dynamic that, okay, maybe I'm a borrower and I'm able to pay my loan right now. But the issue that I'm really going to run into is I've got the kind of asset that is going to be hard pressed to refinance at all or at the level that I borrowed at originally because, I don't know, it's retail. Lenders don't like retail right now, or it's office and half my office building is unoccupied still, or it's hotel. And, you know, it's in an area that's just been really impacted and, you know, just hasn't bounced back the way that it did pre-COVID. So I think those things are things that we're looking at closely. Certainly the lenders are, you know, but it's kind of like, okay, you're making your monthly, but when this loan comes due, you got to pay off this loan, period, the end.
Right.
Right. So how does that get resolved? So that's something that we're looking at, you know, but I do expect that, you know, there would be some opportunities on that front.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up there. You know, as you guys look to some of those nuances to what you're buying, what does a distressed deal look like today that you're buying that makes sense for you?
I'll give you the profile, you know, going back 10 years when like, you know, the world was coming to a capital markets end, so to speak. You know, we were paying some pretty heavy discounts on paper at the time, you know, going down to as low as 20 cents on the dollar to around 50, 60 cents on the dollar. Now, more often than not, we're probably in the 90 to 100 cents on the dollar. Why? Because a lot of the distress that we're seeing really lies at the borrower level and their inability to either service or take out the existing loan. But the underlying real estate has value. So for us to just work through whatever that problem is to get the loan liquidated. And just to be clear, the business plan isn't a backdoor into building a portfolio of real estate at a discount. It's just to get to an exit, however that materializes. So we're looking at it and saying, okay, this is going to deliver an acceptable return for our targets. And so we're willing to pay that kind of value. And philosophically, it's, you know, buy value, don't buy price, you know. So, you know, whenever you talk to stress, people hear discount, you know, but that's not necessarily the case. You're just taking advantage of what is effectively a problem for somebody else is an opportunity for you. And so to that end, I think that's also what contributes a lot to why lenders are sending things our way, because everyone around the table kind of knows what the situation is. Clean asset with a clean story, you know, and the value is what the value is. We'll pay, and they know that. But if there's enough of a problem that it does warrant a haircut, you know, you get 100% vacant, you know, shopping center, but it's in a good area, but it's no, like, it just has to be written down, you know, then everybody around the table knows that too. And so it just makes for a much more seamless kind of transaction. So to us, we're really just focused on the same fundamentals as anybody in real estate. We're looking at good markets. We're looking at asset classes that we like. And we're, I think, in the distress component, thinking about, okay, how does this jurisdiction handle the foreclosure process right now? You know, are there moratoriums? They've all effectively burned off at this point, but like, what's the runway to get resolution? You know, you go state by state. Some of them are weeks, others are years, even if you don't get pushback from a borrower. You know, so these are the considerations that we have.
Wow, that's amazing. A lot of things to think about in the components of what deals make sense. Talk to us on the performing side of things. Why would a current lender want to even sell something that's making money on their books? What's the opportunity there for them, and what's the opportunity for you?
That's a great question. And I would say that that's probably the more active side of the business, because the market is pretty strong and healthy. And you have a couple of situations, but the easiest one to lay out as a scenario, to your point, is when you're a lender, and let's say you make a bridge loan, just to keep it simple, it's a 1-year loan. And let's just say, hypothetically, you are able to get an early repayment on that loan at 6 months, and you're going to put that money out, right? So in a situation like that, you know, you've effectively turned the money twice, right? So your upside is really the origination fees that you'll probably collect on a loan, right? Because the annual rate stays the same when you put the loan out and then put it out again, because it's 1 year, 1 year interest rate. Okay. Now, you're a lender who's doing great business. You're raising money from your investors. You put the money out on loans, and then more borrowers come in the door because you're growing and you have relationships and things are going great because the market is strong and your shop is just getting more visibility and you're getting more business. So you go back to your lenders, you raise more money because your other money's out on the street right now and you have to wait till that pays off, right? And then the next month, repeat, right? Great problem. Okay. So you can only go back to that equity well so many times, right? You know, you've got to basically think about investors constantly, which is something you should be doing anyway. But, you know, you can only go back and say, now we need more money. Now we need more money. Things are great. We need more money. You know, at some point, that well dries up, right? So how do you really address the ability to scale? So if you take, let's say, that same, let's just use $1 million for simplification, right? And you make that loan and then you sell it to my fund, right? You are now keeping the points. And you'll be able to recycle that same $1 million every month, right, over the same 1 year period. So you've turned the money not 2 times, but 12 times. Let's say you've got some drag. So let's say it's 10 times, right? Every time you're turning the money, you're clipping the origination fees. So instead of earning it 1 or 2 times a year, again, you're earning it 10 to 12 times a year. And you don't have to go back to the equity well at any point, because you're using that same $1 million, or, you know, rinse, repeat. So for the lender, it really alleviates this capital constraint that they may have because of a good news problem. They're growing, right? And it also opens up a door to make more money alongside that. For us, what it's doing is I get to think about real estate loans more like how a hedge fund that thinks about building a portfolio of stocks and bonds based on where we like to play. So I'm never going to compete with that guy on the ground in a market like Atlanta or Dallas or Nashville, because it's a relationship game. You need to have all your infrastructure down there. You've got to have originators. You know, you need all of that human resource. And A, that requires just, you know, the bandwidth to just build that out and manage it, as well as the burn rate of paying for all that. Whereas this way, I get to find the lenders who are those guys deep in their markets, who are in a position like we described that need that cash. And I get to construct a portfolio like a fund does, where I want exposure to Dallas. I want exposure to Austin. I want exposure to Nashville. I want exposure to Atlanta. And I can build my portfolio through those relationships. And I know that I'm going to see a flow of loans from those relationships on a pretty steady basis to be able to create that portfolio. And I stay lean on my side doing it while solving a problem for them.
That's brilliant. I love that. I love that. That's really well thought through and a very clear answer. So for you guys, just to cap it off here, you guys then, your long-term play is to hold those until the fund decides that, hey, you know, we've run our course with this loan, and maybe you guys then sell it to someone else, or do you hold it until maturity or until payoff?
I would say we mostly hold it. You know, it's shorter term stuff that we're typically buying, but we do have the ability to sell it off if we want to exit out for whatever reason, just to rebalance our portfolio, you know, because we have a pretty deep relationship base with lenders that we're trading with, you know. And then at some point with a lot of the lenders that we do business, you know, it starts to open up like all sorts of combinations of everything I described. Maybe we'll jump in and actually fund the loan on the front end for a lender if it's like too large for them, and we have enough of a track record that, you know, we think that they're good, you know, they think about risk, you know, in the appropriate way, and they're running a professional shop, you know, or we'll partner with lenders if it's like a big loan, you know. So it starts to almost like, you know, I think the biggest challenge that everybody has in this market, I don't care where you're playing in real estate, is finding deals, controlling the deals. You know, that makes sense, right? And so you really need to get creative on how you access those things. And so our thought process is we're really focused on our counterparty relationships, you know, and helping them solve problems. And so because I'm in the debt space, I think about the lender and what their problem is, right? So if they need liquidity, I buy performing loans. If they have a defaulted loan, I'm solving their problem that way. And then, you know, if we get some things that we think make sense for them, we're trading. And so we're able to create this ecosystem with other lenders that give us much deeper, wider reach, because we're just playing well in the sandbox with all these lenders all over the country. And that just opens up the pipeline in a way that we can really just choose the best.
That's fantastic. I love that, that you've given, again, a lot of really clear answers and just, yeah, pulled back the curtains on how you guys think about raising capital, how you guys think about your relationships in the real estate space, and really just how you've grown your company. So that's fantastic. I have certainly enjoyed this. Thanks for coming on today. Let's jump here into a final few questions, if you don't mind. The first one is this: if you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in the real estate space, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
So I think people tend to underestimate the amount of reserves that they need for this asset class. And that doesn't matter whether you're playing in the debt or equity. Real estate is a large fixed asset kind of game with long duration. It just moves really slowly and it's big ticket. And so a lot of people, particularly when you're reaching to try to make a deal work, you might come in really thin, you know, and that'll just bite you in the ass.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, overestimate reserves that you need, because that rainy day materializes more frequently than you expect. And you just want to be prepared for that. There's nothing worse, particularly with investors, to go back and say, we need more money.
Yeah, that's a painful one. We see it too often. So that is certainly sound advice. Next question for you: when it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
I think that our approach to the investing space and the debt space in particular, we interact with a lot of smaller debt funds, private guys who may have even started their business just a year ago, and it's just absolutely taken off. So you know, in addition to the transactional side and how we work with these lenders, I thoroughly enjoy the relationship aspect, and particularly these private lenders who are just taking these strides to really grow as professionals in their space, you know, and start to conduct their businesses in maybe a much more buttoned up kind of way, and really borrowing from a lot of the business that I've done with bigger multi-billion dollar institutions, bringing it down to that 2-foot level. I just really enjoy that. And I really enjoy seeing a lot of these lenders just kind of just graduate into becoming just much better at what they're doing and becoming much more successful within, you know, their shops. So I love that story. I'm always rooting for those guys, you know, and I think that that comes through. And, you know, I think that's why we do a lot of business with different lenders. But, you know, being able to share with kind of my experiences on here's how things go wrong. I bought going wrong for 20 years. You know, let's step this up over here and over there. So to be able to do that in addition to just making some money together, I mean, that is just the best.
That's awesome. And you know, people, I think the larger you get and the more successful you become, the tougher it is to stay rooted to the common man or woman taking off in this space. So that's really cool that you find joy in doing that, because I'm certain the people that are following in your footsteps, you know, certainly appreciate it. And yeah, that certainly comes through. So thanks for doing that. That's fantastic. David, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Our website, capstackpartners.com, is one way. And my LinkedIn, I'm pretty active on that. So you can find me on there, Capstack CEO, David Blatt.
Wonderful. David, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.